And welcome to Ungagged. This is the pod that almost never was. We've faced infections, lurgy, and hospitalisation, but we've still managed to gobble together a great pod for you to listen to. You can check out the playlist for all our band and artists at leftungagged.org. We've timestamped different contributors, and you can skip to your favourite. This time in Ungagged, we wanted to talk about peace people. We've contributions from George Collins, Sandra Webster, Teresa Durren, Damanveer Kaur, Wee Rafe, and Phantom Power Films presents Alan Bissett. There are many other worthy shout-outs, especially for Victoria Pearson and Neil Scott behind the scenes. I want to say thanks to Chuck Hamilton. He and myself also have a blether later on in the podcast too. If you like what you hear, why not make a donation? A price of a cup of coffee keeps us going. We have hosting costs and our stationery cupboard is looking bare. You can find our donate button on our website or via paypal.me/ungaggedleft. Every little bit is greatly appreciated. We of the Left Ungagged Collective mourn the loss of Savannah Greywind, 22, of the Dakota, who lived with her parents in Fargo, North Dakota. A friend of our colleague and comrade Ruth Hopkins. The young nursing assistant who cared for Ruth's mum was 8 months pregnant when kidnapped on the 19th of August by a white couple who wanted to steal her baby and did. Savannah's body was found in Red River on the 27th of August. Her baby was found alive at her abductor's apartment 3 days earlier. Our hearts are with Savannah, her daughter, and the rest of her family. If you want to chat about this or any other subject on the pod, get in touch. You can follow us on Twitter @_ungagged or find us on Facebook. Hope you enjoy the episode. All the best.
Yeah. Next up on Ungagged, we'll be hearing from Alan Bissett, used with kind permission from Phantom Power Films. You can find out more about them on our website, leftungagged.org.
Hey. Oh, Jeremy Corbyn. Hey.
Right, Jeremy Corbyn, where do we start? Now, in so many ways, Corbyn is very good news, because it certainly drags things further to the left. My entire life I've never known a left-wing Labour Party. The first time I ever had the chance to vote was in 1997, it was for Tony Blair, and I wasn't going down that road. So I've only ever known New Labour. So it's certainly refreshing to see Labour going back to what you could call their roots. And I came pretty close to voting for Corbyn in the general election this year, and I even publicly stated on Facebook that I was going to do it, and then very, very quickly changed my mind. A, I didn't feel good about it at all, given the way that Labour have acted towards the independence movement in the last few years. They've called us everything. They've called us Nazis. They've called us fascists.
There's no difference between those who try to divide us on the basis of whether we're English or Scottish and those who try to divide us on the basis of our background, race or religion.
And I thought, no, I can't endorse that. Secondly, a vote in Scotland for Labour is not a vote for Jeremy Corbyn, it's a vote for Scottish Labour.
Kezia Dugdale, leader of Scottish Labour, just a month ago you wrote, Jeremy Corbyn cannot appeal to a broad enough section of voters to win a general election. Do you stand by that?
Which is a very different thing. And even Corbyn's people know that, that Scottish Labour has a very different flavour than Labour in England. And I was not prepared to endorse Scottish Labour, because I knew what would happen was they would interpret my vote as a unionist vote.
And it looks like a very difficult night for a party that couldn't really decide, was this an election about Brexit or an election about a second independence referendum? It's certainly done huge damage to those people arguing for a second independence referendum.
As a vote against independence. Because Scottish Labour were never going to go round the hoosies going, oh, we hear you voted Labour, but do you still intend to vote yes in future? Oh, that's fine, we'll no count your vote. They're like, well, that's a unionist vote now. So that's exactly what happened. It was interpreted as an anti-independence vote, and I couldn't allow them to do that.
There is one problem with Jeremy Corbyn. In the end, he is a unionist. Why are you a unionist?
Well, you know, nobody has said that to me in Scotland.
Jeremy Corbyn is softer on Scottish independence than I think a lot of his contemporaries have been and are. But he's certainly not in favour of Scottish independence. I would like to see him putting out much more positive noises about working with the independence movement and working with the SNP specifically. But like Ed Miliband, he said before the general election, I won't be doing any deals with the SNP, even though the SNP said that they would like to work with Corbyn. And it's like, well, that's not being reciprocated, so why should I endorse you? What we also have to bear in mind, as much as Labour activists were cock-a-hoop about the general election result, and it's certainly broadly good news that Theresa May lost her majority and that Labour came close to winning the election, is the fundamental thing that all these Labour activists have missed is that the most energised and spirited Labour campaign in which they've returned to traditional Labour values, the most energised Labour campaign I've ever seen, that almost even tempted me, couldn't beat the most shambolic Tory campaign we've ever seen.
Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. We are offering a long-term solution for the sustainable.
And that, for me, is a fundamental issue. So when I'm being told we have to put our faith in the UK and a socialist Corbyn government, I can understand the appeal of that. But all the predictions before the general election about Corbyn being unelectable, although they were clearly exaggerated, they turned out to be right. So why would I put my faith in a party that has lost the last three UK general elections and deprioritised Scottish independence, which we're very close to achieving? Why would I do that? Why would I put my trust in the English electorate to make the right decision on Scotland's behalf when it's proven time and time again that that just doesn't happen? So I'm glad I didn't vote for Corbyn. I understand why many yes voters did. and I'm certainly not going to criticise them for it, but I'm glad I didn't vote. And actually, since then, some of the statements that we've seen Corbyn come out with, he's in favour of a hard Brexit, which puts him in the same policy position as the Tories. He's against the free movement of people.
Would you like to see us leave the single market? You can't tell us.
The single market is dependent on membership of the EU.
You support the renewal of the Trident
deterrent.
It's there
in the programme and therefore it's
going ahead. So what I ask you, Mr Corbyn, do you support the renewal of Trident?
I voted against the renewal of it. Everybody knows that because I wanted to go in a different direction. That is a decision that's been taken. I respect that decision.
If you look at Corbyn's position in Trident, admirably, he said that he's no in favour of Trident, right? So I'll give him that due. And he's defended that position on television very well. But that's not the position of the members in his party. So the Labour Party has to maintain the renewal of Trident because that's a party position. But then he completely flips that on its head when it comes to Brexit. So he must be aware that the vast majority of Labour members, certainly Labour activists, and certainly the left, you know, Momentum, the Corbynistas, are in favour of Remain. And yet he's pursuing a hard Brexit. So he's perfectly prepared to override the politics of his members and activists when it comes to Brexit, but he's not prepared to override the politics of his members and activists when it comes to Trident. So he can't have it both ways.
You would still like to see a united Ireland now?
As for the Irish people to decide, my own view is historically Ireland, yes.
The contradiction with Corbyn and Scotland is shared throughout the whole Labour movement, which is that they're in favour of independence for every nation in the world, especially small nations, except Scotland. Now, that to me is very revealing. So the internationalist argument, the left-wing argument, first of all is in tatters because of Brexit, because it's clear, given that Scotland voted to remain, and given that most people in the independence movement, or most people who voted yes, are in favour of staying in Europe. That proves to me that it's an internationalist movement anyway. But that idea that Corbyn is in favour of independence for the Republic of Ireland, possibly even the reunification of Ireland, so, you know, removing part of British territory and reunifying it with Ireland, that he seems to be fine with. But Scotland becoming independent is anathema to him. And that doesn't make any sense to me. How can you be in favour of independence for every country in the world except the one right on your border? And what that suggests to me is either they don't see Scotland as a country at all, it's just a part of Britain, it's just a region. And in which case, I wish they'd just be honest about that. You know, if that's your position, that's your position. You know, we'll know what we're dealing with when we hear people put forward that position. Scotland's not a country. But they pretend that Scotland is a country for all purposes except the idea of being able to make its own political and economic decisions. So that suggests to me, first of all, a contradiction, second of all, the idea that Scotland's not a country, and third of all, an underlying British nationalism, which is completely invisible to them, because at all costs, the structural integrity of Britain must not be tampered with. Britain has to be the organisational unit for the workers. It has to be Britain. And we're now starting to hear a British jobs for British workers put forward. That argument that was put forward by Gordon Brown, now being put forward by Corbyn. There is an underlying British nationalism within the Labour movement that they are completely unaware of, because they train all their fire on Scottish nationalism. Well, that's nationalism. We can have nothing to do with that. But when you unpick their various arguments about why they don't want Scotland to be independent, it comes down to British nationalism. But I can see that Labour are a left-wing party. But nonetheless, the idea that the structural integrity of the UK must be held together at all costs, even to the point of denying the democratic will of the Scottish people in that parliament right there, that suggests to me that there are contradictions within the Labour movement that they're not even intellectually aware of. And I can't believe they don't even see it.
There's not much around anymore. waiting for you for a long, long time.
Brothers and sisters, because we are all in need of this. The world seems to be skipping further down the path towards a mutually assured destruction, which is mad. I am mindful of some of the songs I remember from school days. How come they're all about peace? Peace is flowing like a river. Give me joy in my heart, give me peace in my heart. It always seems ironic to me though. While the songs that we sung were about happy things and special things like peace, the armed forces were in the library looking for new recruits for things that were totally unpeaceful. Forgive me today because I'm off on a wee bit of a tangent, a different kind of peace. Like many mums, last week I waved to my children as they set off for school. In Scotland, we finish earlier and start later. I did breathe a sigh of relief. Honestly, you could feel it just dripping in the atmosphere, the peace of all the parents in the area of where I stay. However, there's loads of other emotions there. My boys need routine, so the summer holidays are quite difficult for them. This year, the council cut the play schemes, and also, because the boys are in high school, there are no special needs play schemes for them. I tried to enrol them in a camp, a sports camp, but because one of my sons is incontinent, I was told there's no one available to help change him or meet his needs, and I would have to wait. What is the point of travelling two hours on a bus and staying all day? Sorry, but it's not peace for me. However, believe it or not, I like the school holidays. My boys are not stressed out by school and they can relax and do their own thing. They can learn to code this summer and start to do that. Things are expensive, we don't have a lot of money, but as people who are usually Tories keep saying, we do free things. We don't need money. Go with the flow. Yeah, I have meltdowns. I have two sons with special needs. And when one of them's not up for what we're doing, then it can be quite difficult. Though, I hate to say it, but as I'm getting older, and as my boys are getting older, I've learnt more about them and what makes them tick. So I can manage their meltdowns. But please don't tell the social workers that, or those in authority. Right. This is what my piece is about. Because one of my main issues this summer is about pieces, which is Scottish slang for a sandwich, and it's the basic cost of food. My food bills tripled over the summer. I was struggling to feed the children. And I know I'm not alone. I read on social media about a local food bank called Glasgow South Food Bank, who were providing a hot meal for families as well as their usual duties. And one of the volunteers wrote a conversation she overheard. Maybe she shouldn't have put it. But the child was sitting down to a meal and the mum didn't have anything. And the child said to the mum, "Mum, you have this." And the mum says, "Oh, no, I'm fine." And the wee one said, "You're not fine. You've been doing without food so that I can eat." That poor wee boy shouldn't have to go through that, should he? To worry that his parents haven't got enough to meet. If we look at good old Maslow and his hierarchy of needs, food is at the very basics. And we're one of the richest countries in the world. In school, though, I know that my boys get a free lunch And that's a hot meal, which I'm so grateful for. Okay, they have fads and they eat funny things, but at least they get fed at lunchtime and there's a choice of food. I also know that the EIS are recording, you know, the number of teachers and their concerns about the children who go to school without breakfasts and don't have lunches and how they're feeding them themselves. Thank goodness for kind people like teachers. And every time I say it, the cuts are getting worse, and they are, especially in my part of the world. They stopped the special needs play scheme. Next summer it's going to be on, but it's only going to be in the new super special school, which is called Riverbrae. Reminds me of the old song, Oh, You Can't Fly Pieces Out of 20 Storey Flat. But poverty comes in all places. There is poverty from Milgai to Milton, especially with the rise of private landlords. And even people in work, you know, are struggling to meet child cost needs and to feed the children. So it's not just linked to poor children. It's a real issue. But there's a lot that can be done. Now, the Scottish Government have brought about baby boxes, and I think they're a wonderful idea. Jackie Kay, the Macker, who's a wonderful poet, wrote a poem, Welcome to the World. And that's true. We have to welcome our children to the world. But we also have a duty to make the world a better place for them all. So what? It should be a statement of intent. It is a gesture. It is a gesture. But what's going to happen as these children get older? What would my children maybe like? Maybe we could all go down as a family and have a hot meal and have some people organise games and things. Perhaps there could be free travel, access to the pools. Dare I say it? Maybe even outings, even with all the issues about health and safety. As I say, in Renfrewshire, probably next year, Riverbrae, the new super school for children with additional support needs, will have a play scheme. But there's been no word about children in Maryrussell, the other special school, which is not part of the campus, or indeed children with the SN in mainstream schools. So a lot of parents, especially those further down the road than I am, are really, really struggling to make ends meet, to make things better for their children, and to make sure their children are fed. Give your children pieces. So please, give us peace. Give us a peace. As you know, I always speak for a kinder, fairer society. And today I'm leaving you the message. I hope we have a world next summer and that we can all live in peace without any worry about the colour of our skin or religion or anything, or our egos for that matter. So love and peace and hugs to you all, brothers and sisters. Take care.
We'll be right back. be diligent, yet never forget to be flippant, at least when the occasion demands it. Never compromise, except when necessity dictates that you must. And never take a single thing on trust. Never position yourself in a nowhere place just to feed the needs of others. Because although initially you may merely lightly bruise yourself, in time, trust me, you will completely lose yourself. Incrementally, you will lose yourself should you meekly surrender. And if you do meekly surrender, you shall find yourself in a place of unbelonging, longing for a sticking place to screw your courage to. You will find yourself adrift and lost at sea, like the mid-Atlantic accents of the Washington correspondents on the BBC. The old families and the old familiar bloodlines still rule this cursed country, and the trick is to never settle long enough for them to heed you, for them to bleed you. Son, we all need you, as we need all the sons and daughters of this blessed isle to break with the cycle of condition, pain and sorrow, and build the paradise that our generation steadfastly failed to. Son, you must believe. Son, you must conceive of this. You and all our blessed sons and daughters are the architects of tomorrow. Son, 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 son.
Saving luck to them. you found better stuff. Don't make me laugh. It's one and all. Feeling symbol. Sorry, shivers. It's one in. It's the redundancy in, but I'd rather be up on the scrap heap than in the recycle bin. And to all of you replacements, deep down you know you'll never win. One day you'll be here sitting next to me, so get ready to sing. The redundancy. It's worn out, one in. It's the redundancy in. Cast somebody else in my role.
Hello, you good folks out there. George Collins here, coming to you from the beautiful Pacific Northwest out here in the United States. It's a bright, sunny Sunday evening at the time that I'm recording this, and I know a lot of folks out there are gearing up for the solar eclipse that's set to take place tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken. If you are one of them, I hope you get the glimpse that you were looking for wherever you might end up viewing it. The concept of peace, that's what we're dealing with today. It's not a foreign concept to the vast majority of the world's population. It's something we all desire. It's thought of as an inherent good, isn't it? Yet, I, like many people in my generation or around my age group specifically, can't recall a time since at least my political awakening when our country, in the United States, was not at war in some fashion. Now, sure, there was the pre-Iraq War days before the fateful day of September 11th. I was in third grade when that happened, well before I became politically conscious in any capacity. And I remember that morning distinctly. You ask any American who was around on 9/11, who has any kind of memory at that time, and they will likely be able to tell you where they were, what they were doing, all the details. In a similar manner to those who experienced the Kennedy assassination. I was in third grade. The school year had just started less than a month prior. And my parents would occasionally tell me about things they had seen on the news. Nothing super scary or anything to a third grader. But would talk about local events or national things that they thought were important. And I found them interesting, but I didn't comprehend them most of the time because it required an understanding of a context larger than I was capable of. And so when they told me on the morning of September 11th, 2001, that this had taken place, this attack on the United States, unprecedented, the last time the United States had been invaded in any capacity was way back in World War II. And even then, that's a bit of a technicality since that's up in the Aleutian Islands up in Alaska, and of course Pearl Harbor before that. So I found it tragic in the way that a child might think of such things and headed off to school. But unlike all the other stories that I had become accustomed to hearing in the morning, this was something people were still talking about. And more importantly, through the mind of a child, it was something that all of the adults in the school were taking seriously in a way that I had not witnessed with news stories my parents had shared with me prior. And from that point on, all my memories of United States history have been shrouded in some kind of war or armed conflict. I went to a fairly progressive school, and one of the things that they did was have us read the kids' edition of Time magazine, which did not avoid any issues surrounding the Iraq War. They were simplified, of course, so there was a lot of all the backroom deals and all the shady things that went on with Halliburton. You weren't going to get any of that. But we were all still conscious that something was going on over there. And then I remember the presidential election of 2004, where Iraq was a major talking point, and what George W. Bush and John Kerry wanted to do about Iraq were huge issues in that race. And it's continued that way ever since. The Middle East, or West Asia, Central Asia, whatever the term is for it now, has been embroiled in a conflict that we've always been a part of. And it's impossible to go a month without hearing some kind of development in any of that region involving the United States military. And I feel like so many Americans want it to end. I feel like there is a sentiment, especially when I talk to, of course, when I talk to those on the left, but even when I talk to people on the right, when I talk to my libertarian friends who were big supporters of Ron Paul when he was still active, and they would say the same thing. We don't want any more war. We don't want to be in these useless conflicts that are costing us so much money. The United States spends more on its military than the next eight countries combined. Number two is Russia, if I believe that's still the case, and their budget, if it accounts for half of ours, that's the very most it would hit. The great comedian George Carlin observed this all the way back in the 1980s around the first Gulf War, when he talked about the warlike tendencies of the United States, how there's a gap of less than 50 years in our cumulative history when we have not been at war. Even the language we use here at home for domestic affairs, when we want to address something as a problem, we just declare war on it, don't we? The war on drugs, for example. We have the war on terror abroad, you know, the war on poverty. We don't actually do anything about it, but we like to declare war on it. We use that terminology, that imagery. It all comes out whenever it's time to talk about something. Seems like the Americans are addicted to war. But why then, if that is the case, if that is the state of the political elite who profit from all of this conflict, and if I can have everyday conversations with anybody I find on the street, whether I know them or not, or know their political leanings, who would oppose such measures, there's a stark question that I've been thinking about more and more recently, especially in the wake of the 2016 election and the waves of all the activism that we've seen in the United States and even worldwide. Where is the American anti-war movement? Because it's been gone for over a decade and has not resurfaced since. I go back to talking about not really comprehending a lot of what went on with the Iraq War. And a part of that was the anti-war protest. There was a genuine anti-war sentiment after about a year or two of propaganda from CNN, MSNBC, and all these other channels telling us, no, Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, we must go in and dismantle them. Never mind that even if Saddam did have weapons of mass destruction, the most likely supplier would have been us, the United States, in the first place. But they don't like to tell you that on the evening news now, do they? And so people started to pick up that this was a bullshit war, and it ruined George W. Bush's image. I mean, there were a number of things that contributed to that, but ask people in the United States who do not remember George Bush fondly, and I am one of them, what the primary reason for that sentiment would be. It's probably going to center around the fraud surrounding the Iraq invasion. Even in the United Kingdom, it contributed to Tony Blair's downfall when he offered such explicit support, even amidst all the allegations of this fraud that was coming out. And we had more and more countries evacuating their troops. But no, the United States had to stay and play around in the sandbox for a little while. And people picked up on that. That is ingrained in the legacy of George W. Bush. But it's not gone just because Bush left office. The Obama administration increased drone strikes exponentially. In George W. Bush's second term, so this is 2004 to 2008, a grand total of less than 10 automated drone strikes were used in the country of Pakistan. That number shot up to over 300 under Barack Obama's first term alone. And the big problem with drone strikes, and this has been analyzed many times, is that oftentimes we opt for signature strikes, which is where we hit a particular area, as opposed to personal strikes, which are for a specific target. Signature strikes kill a disproportionately high number of civilians. They are a direct contributor to the recruitment for ISIS, for Al-Qaeda, for the Taliban, for all these other groups we want to fight against. Malala Yousafzai, I apologize for butchering that last name, she even said this. This woman who has fought for education for young girls, she was able to recognize this. So where is the anti-war movement in the United States? We had the Women's March, we had the March for Science, we had the March for Truth, all these other things. But the one gap that I see in the American left when it comes to the protests, to the outrage, to making our voice heard on an issue that is gouging us at every turn, there is no anti-war movement right now. That's atrocious. In the same way, I've had to grow up in my politically conscious years knowing the United States is always in an armed conflict. I've also had to grow up knowing that there was nothing stateside pushing back against it. Nothing huge, nothing major on the level that we saw when it came to the Second Gulf War. And I want to call on my fellow progressives in the United States to not lose sight of what it means for us to be in armed conflict all the time. The resources it drains that could go to other things, the way that it keeps global capitalism running amok by enslaving all these countries under this destruction, the way that it destroys the lives, the minds of all of our service members. And regardless of what you think of the U.S. military as an institution, common ordinary soldiers are not our enemy. They just aren't. We can separate the institution from the individuals. That's what I've come to ask for today. If you are a progressive in the United States, remember learning about the Vietnam War. If you're old enough to remember the fervor of the anti-Iraq protests and the sentiment, let's call on that again. Let's get ourselves out of all of these conflicts, and let's make it known that we want that, because when we do, we can tarnish the legacy of any warmonger who sits in that White House. I'm especially encouraged by movements such as Ajamu Baraka's Black Alliance for Peace, Ajamu Baraka being the Green Party vice presidential candidate for the 2016 election, and a man with over 40 years of activist and anti-racist work under his belt. That's a great movement that I've found, and I know that there are many more. Let's grow them even bigger, and let's finally accept peace and shake off the American addiction to war.
Yeah. 89, we say hello. He says goodbye, daddy left when I was four. It made us cry, you and I, Clyde and Bonnie of modern day. Drama came and friends left, but mama stayed through everything. All the fights and all the pain, all the change. I hate my dad, don't want his name. Told my mom that I'm a one, didn't understand all the things going on between her and my dad. But I was stubborn, I know that I make it hard. You always said, son, I know you're gonna make it far. Believe that, I need that in dark times. I think of what you did for me and my heart shines. You took my hand up this mountain, made it your climb. So when I shine, mom, you shine. Yeah, single mother with the yard stack. Raise the king, one day he'll bring it all back. Lived all my life, just me and you. Times got tough and you see me through. I ain't have a dad, we have a plan. Raised by a woman who made me a man. I know I ain't home when your boy is grown. I need you to know that you're not alone. I can let it rock, you will be my stone. Forever in my heart, you will be my stone. My stone. Somehow always found the time. Single parent, it's apparent that you stayed up on your grind. I remember you would put me first. It was hard, but you said, son, it could be worse. You were right, it's funny, looking back, days were sunny. You kept me smiling even though we didn't have the money that other families did. Somehow you made it happen. I promised mom that I'm gonna do it with this rapping. You took me everywhere, my cap and my backpack. 20 years later, now I'm rapping in snapbacks. Rocking a long braid, we came a long way. You kept me on the red road, away from the wrong way. Forever I'm grateful for the life you gave. Tears that we cried, sacrifice you made. Yeah, single mother with the all stack. Raise a king, one day I'll bring it all back. Lived all my life, just me and you. Times got tough and you see me through. I ain't have a dad, we have a plan. Raised by a woman who made me a man. I know I ain't home when your boy is grown.
August 23, 2017, 84-year-old Bapu Sudha Singh Khalsa's hunger strike to free Sikh political prisoners in Punjab reached 950 days. He continues to be forcefully confined at a hospital, subjected to unwanted treatment and force feeding. While there, Bapu Sudha Singh remains under the control of authorities and the government. Recently, politicians raised the issue of these Sikh political prisoners to the Indian government. Dr. Swami, a member of Indian Parliament, wrote a letter on their behalf, urging the government to release them immediately. Additionally, newly elected member of the UK Parliament and First Turban Sikh MP Tanmanjit Singh met with the Chief Minister of Punjab, Captain Amrinder, to seek their release as well. Captain Amrinder has stated in the past that these prisoners should be released. We hope that significant steps will be taken to set them free, and that the mental and physical torture of Bapu Sudha Singh can finally come to an end. Alongside this political effort, activists and supporters around the world continue their awareness campaigns as well. The hunger strike will mark 1,000 days in October 2017. A call-out has been posted for everyone to submit artwork in any medium to help commemorate this milestone. The work must be inspired by the hunger strike and Sikh political prisoners, and can be sent to the email address freesikhpoliticalprisoners@gmail.com. You can view all the submissions on social media under the hashtag art4justice. Art for justice. A worldwide blood donation has been organized the week of October 29, 2017, and will run until Sunday, November 5th. The blood donation event will coincide with the Sikh Genocide Remembrance Week, when in the year 1984 and subsequent years, thousands of Sikhs were brutally murdered at the behest of the Indian government and jailed. The same political prisoners we and Bapu Sudha Singh continue to fight to free. Everyone is encouraged to donate blood during that week and raise awareness by posting their donation photo on social media using the hashtag SikhBlood. S-I-K-H blood. If you're unable to donate blood, you can post your photo with a piece of paper that says, I support at Bapu Sudha Singh. That's BAPUSURATSINGH, hashtag sick blood. I support at Bapu Sudha Singh, hashtag sick blood. You can follow Bapu Sudha Singh's hunger strike on social media. The Twitter handle is at Bapu Sudha Singh. The Facebook page is Bapu Sudha Singh Khalsa Sangharsh Jari Hai, and the Instagram is Sangharsh_Jari_Hai.
Should I cool it before I suddenly say too much about conspiracy and JFK? If bullets hadn't flown in that way, would you and I have happened today? But November 22nd, 1963 might be so far removed from you or me. You're telling me everything's connected by underground seas, rivers in the clouds, spirits in the trees. Here to heaven's not 8, not 7, but 6 degrees of separation. Hell to heaven's not 12, 11, but 6 degrees of separation. I have occupied a place on this planet for some time now, I know. Who set this up and then who ran? It's like some unsolved crime on radio. I can't even say to you what my friends, where one might begin and another ends. disconnected by underground seas, rivers in the clouds, spirits in the trees. Here to heaven's not 8, not 7, but 6 degrees of separation. Hell to heaven's not 12, 11, but 6 degrees of separation. I can't do the mathematics. I don't know how I feel about fanatics who are telling me everything's connected by underground seas, rivers in the clouds, spirits in the trees. Here to heaven's not 8, not 7, but 6 degrees of separation. Hell to heaven's not 12, 11, but 6 degrees of separation. Telling me about 6 degrees, telling me about 6 degrees, telling me about 6 degrees, telling me about 6 degrees. A universe, a lonely sea, washing all over 6 degrees. A universe, a lonely sea, washing all over 6 degrees. A universe, a lonely sea, washing all over 6 degrees. A universe, a lonely sea, washing all over 6 degrees. Telling me about 6 degrees, telling me about 6 degrees, telling me about 6 degrees, telling me.
Is that what you're saying? You're too far away. I can't hear you. Oh, geez, peace. Oh, hello everybody. Red Reef here. Back from a lovely holiday in Germany and raring to go. I hope you didn't think I was being cheeky there when I told wee Vinnie to gie his peace. I actually do mean it. Don't get me wrong, we're best pals, but you keep going on about how he thinks the earth's flat, no ball shaped, and it dain my head in a wee bit. Last night he said, if the earth was round, how come shoes is flat? You can't argue with logic like that, so he thinks he's won. But what about that week, eh? The rise in the far-right Nazis in the US? And no, I'm not going to call them alt-right. They're Nazis, and that's that. But much like the simplistic way we Vinnie try to prove that the Earth's flat, old Fezziwig, or Donald Trump as he's more usually known, try to say the folk that fight Nazis are just as bad as them. Fighting for peace is a concept that folk like Trump clearly struggle with. But when we take a look back at the anti-fascists and the wars of our last century, we see that taking up arms against the armies of Hitler and Mussolini was the only way to stop them. Was my grandpa as bad as Hitler for fighting against him? I think we know the answer to that. And as a conscript, he didn't want to be there at all. So he was fighting for freedom as well as peace. I know advocating war and violence, but be cautious of a world leader who thinks resisting fascists makes you just as bad as them. He has an agenda and knows what kind of folk he really wants to appeal to. The kind that look fondly back to a time when people wear white hoods and have burning crosses. And we has a duty to stand up and be heard now. Didn't he give the fascists an inch of tolerance? Or before you know it, they'll be unstoppable. Anywho, I have to borrow Kirk's globe of the world to try and have whatever we talk to wee Vinnie. I mean, I can go to hang.
I'm in that mood again, want everything to be numb. It's dark at 4 p.m. but my pajamas are, but my pajamas are. I should write a song, make the world less overwhelming, an inspiring one. Instead, I just feel empty, empty, empty. I love my sadness, get the best of me.
How you doing? It's Deb Returns from Ogai. So, again, there's been a lot happening across the globe. Have you noticed that there seems to be never-ending bad shit happening recently? Maybe the solar eclipse was the climax. Let's hope so. We've had your actual real-life Nazis marching with tiki torches in Virginia. Deaths and injuries in the aftermath. We've had the President of America holding his 8th rally. I didn't even know that was a thing presidents done. And blaming many sides. Many, many sides. We've had multiple terrorist attacks across Europe. We've got ongoing famine, flooding, earthquakes. We even had an earthquake here in Scotland. A 3.8 tremor on the Richter scale near Moidart at the beginning of August. You would be forgiven for decrying, the end is nigh. What isn't forgivable, though, is holding up equally doomsday signs at Pride and telling us gays that we are destined to hell. Mate, we are living in one. There were even rainbow flag clad people arrested for protesting at Pride. A protest. There's so much to talk about. But I'm going to talk about something completely different. So in light of statue debates, we at Ungagged have been talking about the different folks celebrated across our dear green Glasgow city. Some of these bronze figurines have no place in the 21st century. But they are history, there's lots of opinions, and all are valid. I want to present a story though, to personalise some of the situations our ancestors were in. The Highland Clearances. Again, recently debated. Were folk incentivised by money? Were they middle-class migrants rather than the persecuted? I've been researching uprisings of the people. It's been interesting and sometimes challenging. There are so many different stories. So many more qualified people to listen to on the subject. But let's give it an Ungagged flavour. After all, the victor writes the history books. So, the political landscape in Scotland at the time of the clearances, which happened over generations, were, well, let's say complicated. But what's new, eh? But the clearances were a systematic displacement of human beings to make way for livestock, mostly. While lairds were off swanning about the royal courts, they needed more and more funds to fuel their lavish lifestyle. These people came from generations of entitlement and nobility. I'm air quoting here, but Scotland had survived for generations on a clan system. The people are loyal to their leader. Till they fuck up, many a chieftain was dethroned throughout our history. And it's this inherent resistance I want to talk about. Resistance is a human fundamental emotion. Think of the wee babby that will resist a food they don't like, the look or the smell of. They'll go, nah, nah, don't want it. And people throughout our history who defy the odds. The guy at that Nazi rally who refused to Heil Hitler. You know the famous photo that's often tagged, be this guy. The baggage handler that punches a terrorist. Resistance is hardwired in us. But imagine resisting, even though it's futile. In Barra in 1851, people were herded onto a ship and told they were being moved out of their homes. Men that resisted were beaten and handcuffed. People who jumped off the ship and swam ashore were shot. And you've got the Battle of the Braes on Skye in 1882. Crofters were likely kinsmen of their landlords, like they were related. It was a throwback to the chieftain system. They had been banned from grazing their own livestock and they just refused to pay the rent. Lord MacDonald turned to law and the Crofton Act came into effect. Polis v Glasgow turned up and a battleship was apparently docked offshore out in the bay. The people revolted with sticks and stones, as you would. But they were injured and arrested. Most of the stories all end with the same thing. People were arrested. They were essentially forced off their land, and the Lairds won. Or did they? There's other evidence of resistance still around today. You probably partake in some and don't realise it. Remember, this was a time of great oppression. This is like the 18th and 19th century Scotland. And the attempts to eradicate a whole culture. The bagpipes were banned, traditional Highland dress was banned. Even recent accounts of how children were punished for speaking Gaelic in school still doesn't quite cover the extent of this imperialistic oppression. But what survived? Well, you've probably heard canters. It's the way that pipers remembered their tunes. Can you write any of this down? And they had to remember their music that was traditionally just passed down by memory. And they'd go like, hum diddly dee, diddly die, diddly do. And it was, this mouth music is epic and it can be heard all over the Highlands and Islands. And it's essentially a way of retaining our culture through impressive adaptability. The same way wearing a kilt was seen as defiance. Celebrating our culture in secret, passing on stories and tunes, traditions and ways. That is resistance. In the end, the people today face many of the same problems with land ownership, but there are more and more stories of community buyouts, and we've got the land reform that's happening, and whole islands have become self-sufficient in energy and resources. I'm looking at you, Egg. Finding out about Skye was really interesting. There's so many more amazing tales to talk about, but this one was quite personal because I found out my Granny Torrance's ma was from Skye. Her name was Kennedy, which comes from the Gaelic meaning son of the ugly head. Talking of ugly heads, the statues and street names around Glasgow have many an ugly head on a plinth. There are reasons beyond slavery and oppression that some of these guys shouldn't be celebrated. And I say guys, because there are hardly any women. I want Jane Haining and Mary Barber statues. Statues to the crofters and clansfolk shifted off their land after generations of dutiful attendance. I want statues of slaves breaking their chains and destroying crates of tobacco that our great city was built on. I don't want to wipe out our history by removing the statues. I just want to tell the whole story. I want to resist this narrative.
There's a woman in a crown, talking on the telly. A woman in a crown, talking about austerity. A woman in a crown, in some kind of ceremony. Woman in a crown. And she's telling me that she lives in the biggest council house I've ever seen. She lives a life of luxury that you might call obscene. Yes, she lives in the biggest council house I've ever seen. A lifetime on benefit. God save the Queen. There's a woman on the telly in a £1 million hat. She's talking on the telly about a welfare cap. I don't suppose the civil list's included in that, but she can still afford to buy a right to buy flat. Cause she lives in the biggest council house I've ever seen. She lives a life of luxury that you might call obscene. She lives in the biggest council house I've ever seen. A lifetime on benefit. God save the Queen. There's a woman on the telly talking about the Tories. A woman on the telly telling aspiration stories. She waves a royal finger to show Europe where the door is. But we still feed her family and we still feed the corgis. Cause she lives in the biggest council house I've ever seen. She lives a life of luxury that you might call obscene. Yes, yeah, she
I've ever saved. A lifetime on benefits.
God save the Queen.
That a woman in the crown, don't like you getting high. The woman in the crown kissed your privacy goodbye. The woman in the crown don't like your human rights. The woman in the crown don't like your right to strike. 'Cause she lives in the biggest council house I've ever seen. She lives a life of luxury that you might call obscene. Yeah, she lives in the biggest council house I've ever seen. A lifetime on benefits.
God save the Queen. The fascist regime ain't no human being.
Hello. This is my personal perspective on peace. An old hippie speaks. Fighting for peace sounds like an Orwellian concept, like singing for silence or feasting for famine. But there's a fine line between passivity and apathy, and aggressors will often take silence as acquiescence, as the former Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, famously said, "If I sit silently, I have sinned." We live in troubled times. That hardly needs saying, unfortunately. But the thing with people spreading discord and shouting hatred is that they're only focused on hearing their own opinions and thoughts expressed. They don't take time to consider the possible nuances behind any silence and lack of challenge to their viewpoint. Their assumption is that, if no one is opposing them, it must be because everyone agrees with them. That's mainly how bullies operate. They see validation in silence, not victory. This means that there does come a point, I believe, where you have to stand up and disagree, dissent, disavow. You then have to keep on doing this. Once you chose to speak up, you can't go back to silence. You can't unsee what prompted you to speak. You can't unthink the thoughts behind your words. And if you do fall silent again, if you fail to sustain your opposition, this will be interpreted as retreat, that you didn't mean what you said, or that you no longer have any valid objections. Or worse, that you've ceased to care. Apathy, complacency, and lack of focus are partially to blame for getting us where we are now. Standing up and speaking out against hatred doesn't have to entail actual fighting, of course. And the testimony of former right-wing activists, which I've read over the last few days, strongly suggests that kindness and empathy are much more potent weapons against them than physical violence or the threat of it. It's quite possible to take a stand and achieve real change without getting physical, as countless examples through history have shown, from Gandhi to Greenham. However, it does have to involve moving yourself out of your comfort zone and putting your head above the parapet to some extent. Each of us, of course, must define for ourselves when this becomes necessary, and summon resources from within ourselves to do this. Speaking personally, I started on this journey with the election of the coalition in 2010. While my progress has accelerated rapidly following Donald Trump's election as president, I still have to do a kind of comic double take whenever I see that written down in actual words. It still feels like an incredible plot twist in a dreadful dystopian sci-fi novel. Having the fuck trumpet to end all fuck trumpets in the White House is proving every bit as toxic and terrifying as many people feared that it might. It's hard to watch as decades of progress are being undone by this paranoid, petulant predator, and impossible not to feel that his baleful influence needs countering by all means possible. Who knows where the murky sediment he's stirring up will ultimately lead? It's already fanning the flames of conflict within the United States and undoubtedly heightening tensions globally. Peace itself is a complex concept, though. One of the dictionary definitions of peace is a situation in which there is no war between countries or groups, which actually makes peace an absence of something, a passive thing, only to be defined when something bad is missing, rather than an active state. This seems to me to be a fairly negative and unhelpful way of looking at it. It's rather like defining summer as, say, the absence of snow, rather than a season to be enjoyed in its own right. If you did this, every day of summer, no matter how glorious, would be touched by the shadow of snow, as it would constantly be hovering at the edge of your consciousness. You would never really have a snow-free day, as it would be the only metric by which you measured the entire summer. Perhaps this is one of the reasons why peace is seemingly so difficult to achieve. If it's just an absence of something bad, what's allowed to rush in and fill the space once war stops? What is done to prevent a recurrence, to deal with bitterness, grievance, loss? In the immediate aftermath of conflict, there may be processes and programs put in place to address these, but they do not and cannot function in perpetuity. Prolonged absence of conflict perhaps creates false confidence. That can't happen here, can't happen again, can't happen to us, can't happen now. Peace between countries, armies, groups of people is one way of talking about this. But what about peace within ourselves? How can we hope to achieve a peaceful community, country, world, when so many of us do not have peaceful minds and have no idea how to change this? If we can't change ourselves, how can we change the world? Is conflict, aggression, war even, massively worsened because people don't know how to be happy? Is it easier to look for some other group or race or religion to blame instead of addressing the gaping maw inside yourself? The price of freedom is eternal vigilance is a famous saying and one which has been on my mind a lot recently. There have been many victories on the road to social justice and equality and fairness, but I didn't understand until now that this progress has to be constantly reaffirmed. It's when the weather is good that we ought to make sure the fabric of our building is sound. It's no use waiting for the storm to find that the roof leaks. But as well as making sure that the building itself is sound, we should also make sure that we check on the well-being of the people who live in the building, ourselves included. The onus is on each one of us to do this. So what am I saying? That peace isn't an absence of something, that it is something real, tangible, powerful, that it isn't exclusively something to be imposed or something that those other people over there need to get their head round, or something that can simply be held in place by laws, statutes and articles, though these things do undoubtedly have a part to play in the process. Peace is, I believe, a living, organic thing, which needs to be fed and nurtured and attended to. It is an active process which demands participation from all of us. It asks for bravery, commitment and consideration. It needs wisdom, foresight and purpose. It is real and it is achievable. It begins with each one of us. Where else can it come from? And has its roots in how we think, what we believe, what language we choose to use. At heart, I'm with the Buddha on this one. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. Thank you.
Reach your poor this is your clever comic cunt coming to you again from Chattanooga, Tennessee, in the land of earthquakes, wildfires, hurricanes, and floods, for another trip down the rabbit hole. First, let me say I'm happy that the Episcopal Church in the USA completely screwed my plans for this podcast, because in this case, that is a good thing. The dean and the chapter of the Episcopal Church USA's National Cathedral, along with the bishop of the Diocese of Washington, D.C., announced this week that they would be removing two windows of two panes each, honoring Confederate Generals Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, complete with Confederate flags, from their installation in the walls of the cathedral. The windows, paid for by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, were installed in 1953. The announcement stated unequivocally that these windows do not represent the values of the Episcopal Church and should be removed immediately, deconsecrated, and stored out of sight until further disposal is decided. Good for you, Bishop, Dean, and Chapter, and thank you. I say that as an Episcopalian, as an American, as a Terran, and as a child of the universe. Looking at the matter objectively and without prejudice, bereft of the late war and postbellum revisionism that is the foundation of the mythical lost cause to which more myths were added later by the Neo-Confederate school of 1890 to 1930, there is no question whatsoever that the Confederate States of America, the Confederacy, was established to maintain and further propagate a socio-economic political system of plantocracy based on the life enslavement of African and Afro-American men, women, and children. But rarely do humans look at history objectively and without prejudice, else American history books would relate that the Union, the states not part of the Great Secession, fought to maintain and to further propagate imperial capitalism, and to keep the southern states as both a source of raw materials and a domestic market for manufactured goods. Neither set of leaders had pure motives. Karl Marx, who wrote numerous articles in support of the Northern cause, was quite well aware of the true motives of its leaders, but deemed the enslavement of humans, especially based on race, to be more evil than imperial capitalism. As for the soldiers in the field on both sides who did the fighting and the bleeding and the dying and killing, they, for the most part, fought for the same reasons as the rank and file of all armies of wars past and present: conscription, manufactured patriotism, and defense of home. And not home as in homeland, but as in home, family, local area, state, in this case. One element of postbellum history largely overlooked is the number of exiled Confederates who fled to other countries in the aftermath. Confederate colonies arose in Mexico, Belize, Honduras, Cuba, Costa Rica, Peru, Venezuela, and Canada, but by far the largest of all, estimated at between 10 and 20,000, grew up in the Empire of Brazil. Of all these, only the colonies in Brazil survived as a distinct entity, today known by themselves and their neighbors as Los Confederados de Brasil. Los Confederados are not divided by race and are in fact multiracial, with members of the ethnic group showing dominant physical traits of either Caucasian or African or even Native American ancestry, or all three, but all clearly mixed. Every year, Los Confederados de Brasil send a number of their young people to the motherland, to the southern states that were briefly the Confederacy, usually hosted by a chapter of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. It is quite an experience to hear a multiracial group of youth switch from speaking Portuguese among themselves to Southern English, and not just Southern English, but American English of the Deep South from a century and a half ago, complete with an accent to rival that of Vivian Leigh's Scarlett O'Hara. Speaking of which, author Margaret Mitchell based her character Melanie Hamilton in Gone with the Wind on her distant cousin, Sister Mary Melody, formerly Mary MacArthur, and her character Rhett Butler on her more famous distant cousin, Doc Holliday. Yes, that Doc Holliday, the best friend of Morgan Earp and his brothers in the Old West. The ancestors of both Mary and Doc, betrothed until he was diagnosed with tuberculosis and went west,
came from Ulster. For Los Confederados de Brasil, Confederate identity does not represent white supremacy nor the subjugation of one race by another, but a shared history which makes them unique as a people. In their case, not one that includes those across racial lines so much as one in which racial lines have been completely obliterated. In the same way, not all those in America who believe in a mythical version of Confederate history, who cling to symbols of the Confederacy as part of their heritage and personal identity, are white supremacists or bigots or racists. Contrary to what the Southern Poverty Law Center claims, membership in the Sons of Confederate Veterans is not restricted to those who can prove direct lineal descent from a former Confederate soldier. In fact, for basic membership, a claim is enough, and that can be through either direct lineal or collateral to uncle, cousin, even in-law descent. And there is even an associate membership for those who have not even that familial relationship. Furthermore, anyone descended lineally or collaterally from anyone who received a pension as a Confederate soldier is eligible for full membership. And there are quite a few Afro-Americans on those rolls. I know, I've seen them in state records. This is not a plug for the organization. I simply despise bullshit, no matter what its source, even from an organization like the SPLC, with which I'm in otherwise wholehearted agreement. If use of Confederate imagery and or symbols necessarily makes one an ignorant, bigoted white supremacist, then explaining Canadian Mohawk Robbie Robertson's motives for writing the song The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down becomes more than a little problematic. It is, in fact, a coded protest against the Vietnam War, drawing an analogy between the poor whites who fought for the Confederacy and the working-class Americans, white, black, Chicano, and Asian, who fought in the jungles of Southeast Asia. If you blanketly condemn all use of those symbols, then you condemn Robbie Robertson as well as Joan Baez, who covered the song. You also condemn Fred Hampton of the Chicago Black Panthers, who formed the original pre-Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition that sprang from their partnership with the Young Patriots of Uptown in Chicago, who rocked the Confederate flag, specifically the battle flag of the Army of Tennessee, and sang Dixie as their anthem. Most of the American subculture which identifies with the former Confederacy for whatever reason is not racist but tribal, either from family history or residence. Back when I was substitute teaching, I did a week of subbing for a history teacher at Howard High School here, the oldest public school in the county and one almost entirely Afro-American. At the time, the class was covering the Civil War. I went there quite excited to share what I had learned of the 1st Color Brigade of the Union Army of the Cumberland stationed in Chattanooga during the occupation. As I perused their artwork on the walls outside the classroom, interspersed with imaginary letters to or from soldiers and sweethearts, however, most identified with the Confederacy. Why? Because the South was their home. However, the nature and history of the Confederate subculture and neo-Confederate mythology lend themselves far too easily to co-optation by racist, white supremacist, Christian dominionist organizations like the League of the South, which is the source of the latest racist, ahistorical buzzword, Anglo-Celtic. In addition to penetrating the former branch of the Scottish Nationalist Party in America, leading to its dissolution by its parent, members of the League of the South have penetrated all too many Scottish heritage events, often having tables at Highland Games across the country. During protests in Georgia, back in the 1990s, over Roy Barnes' unilateral change of the state flag from its 1950s form with the Army of Northern Virginia version of the Southern Cross to what it is now, local advocates in Ringgold of the former flag booed and jeered members of the League of the South speaking as members of the Confederate Citizens Council so vociferously that they fled under police guard. During my single year of membership in the SCV, League of the South penetration of it was mostly confined to the Southern Brigade of the Georgia Division. Since then, however, it has taken over leadership of both the Georgia Division and the national organization, though pockets of resistance remain. Keeping in mind that personal use of Confederate symbols do not necessarily constitute an expression of white supremacism, such display by local, state, or federal government entities does, in fact, validate that very thing. The only places Confederate monuments and memorabilia belong are in Civil War military parks, museums, and cemeteries, just as the only acceptable place for Confederate cosplay, or for that matter, Union cosplay, is at Civil War reenactments. If history buffs or Confederate romanticists want to commemorate former Confederate generals truly worthy of venerable remembrance, erect monuments and statues to James Longstreet and William Mahone, both of whom worked hard to build a biracial society in the postbellum South. Longstreet in New Orleans fighting with Afro-American militia against the Knights of the White Camellia, and Mahone leading the biracial readjuster party in Virginia against the redemptionist Bourbon Democrats. Or Irish-American General Patrick Cleburne, who literally risked his life during the war by proposing to free the slaves along with their families and make them full citizens in return for service in the Confederate Army. Our day will come, inshallah. Keep the faith. Peace out.